All right. Come with me on a story here. So it's 1947, and some shepherds are leading their flock along, and they're going along the banks of the Dead Sea. And it's just a really barren area, but there's a lot of caves up in the hills. So they're leading their shepherds, and they're getting probably a little bored of the very vast wasteland of the Dead Sea. Is so salty that it kills pretty much any vegetation or anything that kind of gets close to that area. So just kind of walking through, but there's caves up in the hills. So they're getting a little bored maybe, and one of the shepherds just starts throwing rocks, seeing if he can, I don't know, like baseball throw them into the caves. So he's throwing rocks, and he's just going, you know, cave by cave. And then for one of the rocks, he throws, and he hears this shattering sound. And he doesn't have time to go up and investigate at the moment, but he takes note of that sound, and he goes, and he finishes the rest of his day doing his shepherd job. And he goes back the next day during some sort of down period. He wasn't needed. And the shepherd goes back to that same cave where the shattering sound came from. And he goes to investigate that noise. And in the caves, he finds 12 clay jars. And in that moment, he makes the most important archaeological discovery in recent memory. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found among some of the other things that were in those same clay jars. Going from 1947 to 1957, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in hundreds of caves along the Dead Sea. But among those scrolls that were found was the Great Isaiah Scroll. And this was a complete document which contained the entire Hebrew manuscript of Isaiah. And, you know, that's kind of boring. You're like, okay, well, why does that matter? Well, up to that point, the only complete document we had of the book of Isaiah was from about 1,200 years before this one. So the original Isaiah scroll that we had was from around 800 AD to 1,000 AD, somewhere around there. But then the great Isaiah scroll was 1,200 years older than that. So it was somewhere around 400 BC. So Isaiah is thought to have been written around 700 BC or 600 BC, somewhere around there. And so that is a huge, huge gap between somewhere around 1,000 AD to 700 BC. You know, but you find a complete manuscript which is almost exactly identical to the one we had later on. And suddenly you have a little bit more authenticity, right? It feels more real because it's closer to when the original was written. So you figure it probably has less errors, less scribe errors when, you know, they didn't have printers. So they were just writing down every word that they saw. So it was known that sometimes scribes can make errors in that. But you go back and you see just how complete and just how similar, almost identical they were. What's also important is that scroll itself was from 400 years, roughly, before Christ lived. Now, why does that matter? Isaiah has the most complete and detailed prophecy of the life, death, and eventually resurrection of Jesus. And it explains exactly how he will take away the sins of the world. Because of this, many have called Isaiah, and I specifically, the chapter we'll be looking at today, Isaiah 53, the fifth gospel, or the gospel of the Old Testament, or the gospel according to God. This chapter, more than any other part of the Bible, makes clear for us the true meaning of Christ's life, death, and again, resurrection. All of this in a book which was written hundreds of years before Christ's actual life on earth. John MacArthur, who was a longtime pastor and theologian, passed away in this last week. And I was listening to some of the things he said about Isaiah 53 in preparation for this message. And something he said stuck out. He called this chapter the root of gospel theology and the root of Christian thinking. So basically what he's saying there is that this chapter specifically influences the rest of the Bible. If you look at the New Testament, even in the Gospels and in the Epistles, Romans, Paul is incredibly influenced by this chapter, and we can see that in the theology that you can see branching out of this idea. And so in that, we know that Isaiah 53 is an incredibly, incredibly deep chapter. It has so much theology and so many connections to different parts of the Bible and newer parts. And it has so many specific prophecies that connect to the life of Jesus. There have been 900-page books that have been written about this. There have been sermon series that last months and months. We're going to try and go through it all in less than an hour, so we're going to try and speed things up here. So buckle up. We're going about 200 miles per hour through this book or this chapter. To start out with, we'll give you just a little bit of context about the book of Isaiah. Isaiah is kind of split up into two parts. The first part, which is chapters 1 through 39, and that's a lot of talking about the nations that were around Israel at the time and Israel itself and how they had done something wrong and they had gone and sinned and God was going to punish them. But a lot of times there was the little hint of hope where, all right, you can come back and you will still have hope. One second, let me grab some water. So it's kind of more judgment-focused in the first half. And in the second half, we start getting a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more prophecy specifically focused on the Messiah, so Christ and the future kingdom that Christ would come in and bring about. So we're solidly in Isaiah 53. We're solidly in that section. Isaiah 53 is the fourth of four servant songs that are in the book of Isaiah. The first one in chapter 42, the second in chapter 49, the third in chapter 50, and now this one, which is in chapter 53. It also contains the last three verses of chapter 52. So now that I've said that, let me explain. The chapter that we're going to go through is going to start in chapter 52, verse 13, and it's going to go through the end of chapter 53. So if you haven't turned there already, turn there. And so the chapter divisions that were given and the verse divisions were added way later than the book was written. So when the book was written, it didn't have any of these verse or chapter headings. They were added later to give us a little bit, like it's easier to go to chapter 53 than it is to try and find the same page on different things. So we're given these. But with that, we see that the servant song begins at verse 13 of chapter 52. So we'll take a look here, starting in chapter 52, verse 13, and then we'll, again, try and go through as fast as we can the 53rd chapter. Let's read verses 13, 14, and 15. We're going to separate today the chapter into five divisions, each containing three verses. So our first section is 13 through 15. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what had not been told them, they shall see, and what they had not heard, they shall consider. So the song starts with, behold my servant. So we know this is the character we're looking at. God is introducing, behold my servant, which we know is Christ. This is the same beginning as the first servant song, and so it kind of is the bookend of the first servant song had it, last servant song had it. Behold my servant. This is the longest of the servant songs. And so verse 13 kind of starts out kind of similar as the first three songs. The first three songs are very focused on this is going to be great. His my servant is going to come, and he's going to take over all these places, and he's going to deal justly with everybody, and he's going to do great. So verse 13 kind of starts out in that same way, saying how the servant will deal prudently, and he'll be exalted and extolled and be very high. But then verse 14 comes in, and it completely shifts what we're looking at. Before, we were looking at someone who is conquering, and he's doing all of these great things, and it's the same person, but then we get a little bit of added context, right? And then we get verse 14, just as many were astonished at you, so his visage, so his person was marred more than any other man. That is a huge shift in tone. It tells us that this man, my servant, will be so destroyed beyond the point of recognition as a human. I mean, his visage, his person, will just be annihilated. We can see that in the way that the cross and crucifixion destroyed the body. And then verse 15 kind of gives us the end result. So shall he sprinkle many nations. So we get, behold, my servant will be lifted up, but he's going to be marred more than any other man. And through that, he will sprinkle many nations. Now, sprinkle is associated to the Old Testament practices of the time where the priest would come in and he would sprinkle either blood of the offering that was given, or it could mean some other things, but it's associated with cleansing. So this is how he's going to cleanse many nations. And that would have been kind of weird hearing as a Jew, because at the time you're thinking, oh, well, only Jews can be saved. This is our God that he doesn't share. But he's giving this. Many nations will be saved through this sprinkling. And then we see the last two lines there of verse 15, for what had not been told, they shall see, and what they had not heard, they shall consider. So this is a completely new idea. This is something that before you wouldn't have gotten, and no man is going to come up with himself. I don't think a man would come up with, all right, well, to be a conquering king, I need my conquering king to die a horrible death. That's not something that just anybody is going to come up with. So it's a completely new idea. Jesus will become king, but before he is lifted up in glory, which verse 13 talks about, he must be lifted up on the cross. So it gives you kind of that irony, that idea where to get hot, to be lifted up, the servant must be first put to shame. Let's move on to the second section here, verses 1 through 3, and that'll deal with the suffering servant's rejection. I'll read that here. Who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness that when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. So we see Jesus, the suffering servant's rejection here. This section begins with a question. Who has believed our report? That is, when this section is talking about we, or it's talking about our, it's talking about specifically the Jews of the time, specifically. But through that, the our and the we that we see through the rest of the chapter can be applied to us. So when we see we, a lot of times, and most of the time after this, it's going to be in a bad context. We did something bad. We did something bad. But the servant did something good. But starting out, who believed our report? So is there anybody who's going to believe this story of the servant? And the grammar in the Hebrew of this section is expecting a negative result. So the answer is few. Few people are going to believe it. Seldom there's going to be none who believe it. And then we have this arm of the Lord here. And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? This is another messianic title, or at least it's a figure of speech which has been used before in Isaiah, which specifically is talking about God's resurrection power, God's ability to save people through grace. So now we start to shift, going from verse 1 to verse 2. We kind of see a shift now to the actual life of Jesus. In verse 2, for he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. So it's kind of this picture of a green, healthy plant coming out of a barren, dry ground. Now, what is that talking about? Jesus is kind of this life that's coming out of something dead. This could be talking about him coming as just another baby, coming out of a dead nation. So at the time when Jesus was born, Israel would have been considered kind of dead spiritually, right? They had all of these laws that they followed. They did all the right things, but they had no relationship. So they were dead in rules. Or it could be talking about a dead bloodline. Mary and Joseph weren't really considered royalty at all. He was a woodworker. He didn't do anything impressive beyond that to where he was a king. So Jesus is kind of coming out as this plant where you wouldn't expect it from. So what we see is through this, we know that there's no real earthly reason why we'd follow him. It says there's no beauty that we should desire him. So it's not like Jesus is coming with any earthly glory that Israel was expecting. Israel was kind of coming and they were expecting, oh, this king's going to come down and he's going to be just conquering, just huge destroyer, and everybody's going to know. But this kind of subverts that expectation. It takes us as my servant, but there's no reason to follow him earthly wise. And that's kind of given as a reason that in verse 3, he is despised and rejected by men. This is the rejection of the Jews and ultimately the Gentiles also of Jesus. Rome and Israel worked together to crucify Jesus, giving Gentile nations and Israel no excuse at his death. And it tells us that the servant will be familiar with rejection, sorrow, pain. We can see that in the life of Jesus through him weeping over Lazarus, to him being pained, seeing at the crowds which were like a sheep without a shepherd. We can see that ultimately, obviously, in the death of Jesus, where he was pained. Again, the "we" Israel is speaking of is Israel. It's Israel specific, but then on a more general note, can also be applied to us and everyone. And you can see that "we" is kind of the villain in this story. Every reason that the Messiah has to do something, or every bad thing that happens to him, is our fault. Now, he does it intentionally, and he does it on purpose. He knows it's going to happen, but it ultimately is put on, we didn't accept him. We rejected him. Now let's move on. I told you we're going to go fast. We're going to be in verses 4 through 6 next. 4 through 6, we'll be looking at the suffering servant's burden. Verse 4 says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted." We'll stop there. We're moving on now to kind of what Jesus did through his earthly ministry. We saw in Sunday school today that this, my translation says, "borne our griefs and carried our sorrows," but those can also be, they're more a physical focus. So we see Matthew uses this verse as an example of Jesus is fulfilling prophecy by healing people because he's fixing, or he's bearing our griefs and carrying our sorrows. in a physical manner. But it also does have the spiritual aspect to it, where Christ is taking on our spiritual afflictions. There is a idea of curse coming out in the second half of that verse. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God. There's the idea of he's cursed by God because that's how we see him. And we see through Deuteronomy 21, it tells us that whoever hangs on a tree is cursed. And then we see later on, Galatians 3, Paul uses that verse in Deuteronomy to tell us Jesus took our curse. The curse that anyone was for hanging on a tree, that's our curse. We had the curse of sin, which we can't help. We're born with this curse of sin. We can't help but sin in our lives. Jesus takes that curse upon himself on the cross when he's hung on a tree. So it's kind of that cool spiritual meaning that Paul brings out in Galatians. We can see elements of that here. And now we get to two of the most beautiful and ultimately devastating verses in the entire Bible. It's what Rich came up and read for us. I just want to read both of those verses out, and I'm going to read them kind of slowly so we can really take it in, because this is the center of all of what this chapter is talking about. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement, that means punishment, the punishment for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That is a devastating group of verses. We see in this that we are completely at fault for the death of Christ. Taking a look at this, the wounded in verse 5, but he was wounded for our transgressions. Maybe your translation says pierced. That's a good translation of the word, but he was pierced for our transgressions. Christ was pierced in many ways on the cross, through his hands and his feet, with nails being driven through him so he could be nailed to the cross. He was pierced in his side when he was already dead. That would have gone through him and into his heart. And then ultimately he was pierced also in his head when they put a crown of thorns on his head. So in many ways he was pierced, and it was for our transgressions. This was put on him, not for his sake, not for the sake of him wanting to just be great and wanting to die in some way, but this is for us. He did it because of our transgressions, for our iniquities, just different words for sins, for things we've done wrong. The chastisement, the punishment for our peace was upon him. And stripes, Rich read it in the NASB, right? It says scourges, which deals specifically with whips, the whip marks, the stripes that are on the back of Jesus. Jesus was pierced, he was bruised, and he was given stripes on his back. Bruised through beating, stripes through, again, the whipping. All for our sake. The peace that it's talking about here, the chastisement for our peace was upon him. That's a spiritual peace. It's the peace that passes all understanding. It's an existential peace, right? You know that my sins are forgiven. I'm good. I am at peace because Jesus has come and he has paid the penalty that would have meant the opposite of peace. Then we go into verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. left to our own devices, if we're left by ourselves, if Jesus never came and took our penalty for sin, we would never be able to pay for ourselves. We are all like sheep. And I'm not a shepherd myself, but what I have heard about being a shepherd is that the hardest part about being a shepherd is that sheep are dumb. And we're kind of in that way. We are, I mean, I'm not calling you names or anything, but I know I'm done. At times, I just do the worst thing. There's like a perfectly well-paved path. Like I see that that's going to a good place, but I could go down this way to a place that looks awful. And for some reason, I make, you know, the wrong decision. I sin in that way, or I go in the wrong direction that God's trying to lead me away from. And we can't help but doing that. It's the sin nature in us. It's the original sin that has been passed down from generation to generation. And because of the fact that we have gone astray, Jesus needed to come down, and our iniquity, the things that happened because the punishment that was necessary because of me, because of my sin, that's what was laid on him at the cross, paid for by his blood. This is a complete spiritual healing from sheep who are gone astray and needing or deserving death to men who are at peace through Jesus' blood. We're now going to move on to verses 7 through 9. 7 through 9, and that's going to be looking at the manner of the suffering servant's death. We go from the idea that Jesus is directly taking our punishment on the cross, and now we are going into describing his death, and then there'll be one verse about his burial at the end of this section. So, verse 7 says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." This is telling us through the words, "open not his mouth." This speaks literally of Jesus before his accusers, not being completely silent, but not defending himself. So we looked at Jesus when he went to the Jewish Sanhedrin, and when they started accusing him of things, he didn't defend himself. Because if he did defend himself, he had literally the best answer. He could just say, "Yeah, I've never done anything wrong in my life." And for any of us, that would be a lie. But for him, that's a perfectly good defense, because it's true. So if he did go and he defended himself, he would be completely in the right. But it's important to see that when he was put before Pilate, when he was put before the Jews, he didn't defend himself, which shows us that literally he was staying silent. But it also shows us figuratively that he's going to the cross not because he has to or because he's being forced, but because he wanted to. He went willingly and humbly. He voluntarily debases himself. He is subject to horrible punishments, to horrible beatings and scars. And just as we said in the beginning of it, his body being marred beyond any recognition of what should look like a person. He put that on himself and took it willingly for us. That is ultimate humility, that God, who has ultimate glory, would not only come down and live a life of a man, putting away some of those aspects of, he was fully God, but willingly not using some of that omnipresence and that idea, some of those bigger forms of God, and being debased just by being a man. Because that's not what God should be. And then going further and going beyond what any man would usually do and going and being beat, scarred, and hung up on a cross where he would hang for hours. Again, ultimate glory, ultimate humility, ultimate punishment. This whole thing reminds me of the last song we sang, specifically that second verse. Behold the man upon a cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished. At Christ's death, when he was hanging up on the cross, he could have just gone, and they were telling him, oh, if you're God, just come down all by yourself. He could have. He was God. He could have called a million angels to come and take him off the cross. But he willingly stood there, and it was my sin that held him there. If I was in the crowd, I would likely be among the scoffers telling him, hey, get off the cross. If you're really God, do this. When he was up there paying for my sin, he could have gave up on us. At any point, he could have just decided, ah, these people, I'm just, you know, they don't need me. If they really don't want me, I'll just leave. But in ultimate act of love, an ultimate act of compassion, he stood up on there, on that cross, and took my sin, took your sin, took all sin. Verse 8 describes the confinement leading to his cutting off. So we'll look at that. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people, he was stricken. The term there, who will declare his generation, it basically just means he's cut off at the height of life. He was 33. I mean, he would have had plenty of time left. This makes it very clear in this passage that Jesus died on that cross. There have been many lies and many theories over the generations, over the 2,000 years since Jesus has died, that, maybe he didn't die. Maybe he just kind of like swooned a little bit, like passed out for a while, and then he woke up in the tomb and was like, wow, this is weird. But that's not how that worked. It makes it clear here that he was cut off from the land of the living. He died on that cross. No apparent death, real, physical, agonizing death. Verse 9 then gives us actually really a pretty cool description of how they would bury him. Verse 9 says, and they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. And so that gives us actually a really cool picture of what happened to Jesus. Crucifixion, when the Romans would crucify someone, you know, they'd let him hang there, and after the person died, usually they would just kind of let the body sit there, and just, you know, animals would come to it, and they'd just let it decompose up there. It was so lifted up so you could see, anybody passing through would be able to see that, oh, those guys did something bad. Like I better not mess with Rome, because if I end up like them, this is not going to be a good day. So it says originally, and they made his grave with the wicked. So what they would do is after they had let it decompose for a while, they'd bring him off the cross, they'd, you know, take him off the wood, and then they would just dump him into a mass grave where everybody who was ever crucified would just kind of be laid in there. And so this actually gives us a really cool picture of that. They made his grave with the wicked. That was the plan for his body. But then we see the second part of that, but with the rich at his death. So actually what happened to Jesus was a man named Joseph of Arimathea offered his burial place. He was a rich man, and he offered his tomb for Jesus. So we can see the prophecy of Joseph of Arimathea giving him his tomb to go lay with the rich at his death. And then we see, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. That gives us, for sure, this tells us Christ was sinless. This isn't just some normal guy, because any normal guy wouldn't be sinless. So that really is directing us in an indirect way that this perfect man can't just be a perfect man. Like, this is God. And so we can see that in this verse, that Jesus is God, which makes it all the more devastating that we killed him. The perfect man of God is the one who laid in the tomb. Moving on now to the last section of Isaiah 53, we're going to take a look at the suffering servant's reward. So what everything happened out of that. Verse 10 says, "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hands." The word "yet" it holds so much meaning here. So we just got done describing the awful death that Jesus would go through, that servant would go through. He would go through beatings and scourges and bruises, and then he would be silent, and he would just be destroyed in the height of life. And then it says, "Yet God was pleased, the Lord was pleased to bruise or again pierce him." It pleased God to pierce him. Notice that it's God in action that can show again that this was God's idea and not just man. But man literally beat, they tortured, and they killed Jesus, who was God. They beat and killed God. That's the worst thing that you could ever do. That's the worst thing mankind could ever do. And then God looks at that and he's pleased? Well, on the surface, that doesn't make any sense. We can see that it pleased the Lord to put him as an offering on our behalf. Why? Because God's love and his desire for us to be made right with him was stronger than even the worst crime that mankind would ever commit as a species, literally killing God. God's love was stronger than that. Hebrews 12 calls this the joy that was set before Christ. And the reason Christ endured the cross was because there was a happy ending, that we would become right with God through faith. Verse 10 talks about he being Jesus, he shall see his seed. Normally that would be talking about children in the Old Testament, this word. But in this way, it's spiritual children. It's those of us who do believe. Christ, the joy that was set before Christ, the reason he endured the cross, is because he saw you, is because he saw me, and he saw that we could be made right with him through that action. It says prolong his life, that gives the idea of Jesus rising again. It says he shall prolong his days. Jesus rising again and having eternal life after that. We see then in verse 11, he shall see the labor of his soul. That makes me feel good. Jesus values you in a way that he labored his soul so that he could be with you. You are the labor of his soul. That's a lot of, it's a work. It's a care. He was satisfied with dying. He was completely satisfied. Because by his knowledge speaks of his knowing his mission and doing his mission right. By that, his righteousness would be able to justify many because he bore their iniquities. That's amazing. Jesus has and will be rewarded by being in a relationship with us. So that goes on us then. Will you willingly be in that relationship? Jesus died. Jesus went through everything. He went through as close to hell as a man could go through so that you could be in a right relationship with him. Are you valuing that? Are you giving him the time that that kind of relationship would deserve? That kind of love that took a man to death, took God to death. Are you taking advantage of that? Have you accepted his gift, but then are you staying close to him and keeping that relationship alive? To finish, we get the last verse, verse 12. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great. That's speaking of like a conqueror. It's like Jesus has gone, and instead of doing what people would expect and going and what the Jews expected of conquering Rome and taking over and establishing this great kingdom, which eventually he will do, establish a real physical kingdom. But what he came and he did is died. Completely opposite. But what's the result? He is given a portion. He is getting a reward as a conqueror, getting a portion with the great. And he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Still talking about that. And then we kind of get a list of what he does for us currently. Because he poured out his soul unto death. And now, there's a lot of things that Jesus does for us. So "and" is kind of significant here. We could keep going, but it just gives us some of the things. And he was numbered with the transgressors. Literally, perfect God called a sinner. And he bore the sin of many. He took those sins upon us, completely foreign to the nature of God, which is holy, and set apart away from sin. And he made intercession for the transgressors. That is what Christ does for us. Hebrews tells us that Jesus is our mediator and that he gives intercession. Intercession meaning he is kind of the middleman between us and the Father. He makes intercession. He pleads for us ultimately through his blood, but then also through our prayers. For the transgressors, the transgressors is us. He makes mediation for us. That's where the chapter ends. What Jesus is currently doing for us. He made all of those sacrifices that we could have a relationship with God, and now he is currently interceding for us on our behalf. Now, what we did was basically just flying down the road. Like if you were to go up in the mountains are very beautiful. If you were to fly down the road at 200 miles per hour, you could kind of recognize that there's a lot of beauty hidden in those mountains, but you might not have gotten the full picture. So this chapter is kind of compared to the most beautiful land imaginable, and we just flew through it. We got a taste of its beauty and the greatness of this passage. But I really hope that this sermon will ultimately inspire you to go in and continue studying this passage and ultimately the Bible as a whole. Because there's so much in here. As I said, books with hundreds of pages have been written about this chapter alone. Countless sermons could and have been made. Each verse in this chapter has enough theological depth to make the ocean look like a kiddie pool. I mean, it's so deep. To finish up, just to give you a little summary, I'd like to give you some of the specific prophecies that we looked at from this passage that were literally fulfilled by Christ. One, we can see in verse 14 of chapter 52 that Jesus' body would be incredibly disfigured in a way that only points to crucifixion. Number two, we see in verse 2 of chapter 53, it says that Jesus wouldn't have any physical tells or any extravagant physical beauty or any reason physically why we would say that he was great, which ultimately is fulfilled in Jesus. Verse 3, number 3, chapter 54, verses 3 through 4, Jesus would be aggressively rejected despite healing many, despite taking on the physical burdens of many. Number 4, 53, verse 5 tells us that he would be pierced, bruised, and given stripes, again, only pointing towards crucifixion in that way. Number 5, in verse 6, it says that through his pain and death, our sins would be laid upon him. So we can see that fulfilled through Jesus' death and what he said, and ultimately what was said after him through Paul and Peter. Number 6, 53 verses 7 and 8 tells us that he would be silent and not defend himself before he died. And he did that when he was before Pilate and when he was before the Sanhedrin. Number 7, 53 verse 9 tells us that he would be buried in a rich man's tomb. That happened. Number 8, 53 verse 9, the second part of that tells us that he would be sinless, which in turn means that he would be God. Number 9, 53 verse 11 said that many would be saved through him. We're in America, which is across the world from Israel where he lived. If you don't know that a bunch of people have been saved by him, it's there, 2,000 years worth of it. And then number 10, he would intercede for sinners with God. That's from verse 12. Intercede for sinners with God. The parallels between this passage and the rest of the Bible, and ultimately the rest of the New Testament, are too numerous to count. Every doctrine of salvation, grace, and atonement brought to you by the blood of Jesus, they can be seen in this passage. And I hope through everything that we've gone through that you've gained a deeper understanding and ultimately a deeper faith in salvation and the factuality of that, because Isaiah was written hundreds of years before Jesus, and we can see all of these things that are from Jesus' life. We're going to sing, so if the worship team could come up.